those outside the U.S., the long-known issue of American gun violence can seem like a bleak exaggeration. Unfortunately, it is the prevailing truth. For example, it only took 3 hours of the beaches being open in Chicago for someone to draw their weapon and open fire at others present. The result of shootings in Chicago alone over the weekend added up to 9 dead and over 40 wounded. Gun violence transcends the liberal-conservative state divide. On May 6, conservative Texas experienced a horrific mass shooting at a mall where a gunman opened fire on random targets, killing even children before being shot dead by local authorities. Then, to end the month, 5 more people were shot dead in a single night in Stockton, a city in liberal-controlled California. The dozens of shootings sent shockwaves across the U.S. Notably, the police forces in the U.S. are also a significant factor contributing to this cataclysmic pandemic. Last year, they shot and killed the most people on record. This comes only 2 years after the George Floyd uprising, the biggest uprising in the United States history, which sought to put an end to police brutality. Excess arms from the U.S. military are auctioned off or donated to police forces domestically, creating a hyper-militarized police force that feels emboldened to shoot first and ask questions later. One would think, with an epidemic level of violence gripping the nation for decades, that a bipartisan political solution would be found. However, even gun laws are seemingly useless. Between the failure of local authorities to enforce certain bans, to the ease of transport of weapons from states that lose laws to strict laws, the proliferation of guns on the street continues. One only needs to travel 10 miles outside Chicago, where there is a ban on assault weapons, to purchase an AR-15 and bring it back to the city. The Small Arms Survey and Independent Firearms Research Project found there are more guns in the United States than there are people, and firearms companies have no intention of slowing down production. In fact, during the COVID-19 pandemic, firearm sales skyrocketed, even causing ammunition shortages in liberal states like Illinois. Above all is the United States Constitution itself and the Second Amendment, which guarantees the right to bear arms, is second only to the First Amendment, which promises so-called freedom of speech, religion, and assembly. Many politicians outright refuse to limit the Second Amendment, stating the Constitution is the perfect document that cannot be altered. Liberal politicians even fall short, fearing the bending of one constitutional right will lead to the bending and retraction of others. The lack of political action, combined with the ongoing proliferation of guns, creates a perfect storm every summer, where Americans are more likely to be outside harm's way. Without fail, every summer in the United States is marked with mass shootings, the political blame game, then the rinse and repeat. Even if Americans somehow usher in an era without guns, the fact is the cycle of violence remains. At the heart of the issue is something the American public needs to struggle with: widespread poverty, depleting mental health conditions, a life without stability and dignity for millions of people. Violent crime in the United States is but a means to an end for thousands of people. Look at where most of the pockets of violence are, and you will notice a pattern: closed schools, closed factories, closed hospitals and clinics, and a population forced to deal with the brutal reality of American life, a life that is not popularized on television and magazines. In Chicago, then-Mayor Rahm Emanuel closed 50 schools, citing a reprioritization of the budget. Students who were once within walking distance of their schools now had to find alternative routes, rely on broken transit services, or endure extremely long commutes just to get to school. For many students, this was near impossible, and as expected, dropout rates increased. With no education, promising students are transformed into alienated workers, and ultimately many resort to a life of crime to make ends meet. It's not just the lack of educational opportunities. Entire cities like Detroit, which experienced a massive shutdown of factories for decades, are left with hundreds to thousands of workers who once had it all but now are forced into the streets. Government safety nets are non-existent. Housing and food benefits are cumbersome to attain, and the government is actively gutting them. The Biden administration cut SNAP benefits in March, which takes away food and resources from millions of people. Coupled with this is a hyper-militarized police force that is notoriously known to shoot, kill, and walk away freely. Americans are stuck in a paralyzed state of violence that is not taken seriously politically and accepted as an everyday reality socially. As summer begins, Americans will need to again reckon with the harsh reality and the threat of imminent violence once again. The reality is that shootings will continue and people will be killed until the root causes and issues are addressed and resolved. And currently, there is no political leadership or social movement strong enough to reflect that change. According to the website of Kaiser Family Foundation, gun injuries, including suicides, are the leading cause of death for children and teens nationwide. But the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention does not differentiate which injuries come from stray bullets, and electronic health records don't typically record how patients feel about their safety. For decades, the definition for these adverse childhood events have excluded exposure to community gun violence. Nina Agrawal, a pediatrician who has researched how such experiences have been handled, said, "That means young people exposed to shootings outside the home have been without access to broad range of intervention efforts and support at various stages of life given to youth facing other forms of traumatic events such as child abuse or household dysfunction."
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Yeah. The first UN investigator allowed inside the notorious U.S. prison at Guantanamo Bay said the 30 remaining detainees in the facility are facing ongoing cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment under international law. UN Special Rapporteur Fionnuala Niall-Lane issued a report on the facility and told reporters in New York that significant improvements have been made in Gitmo since torture at the prison was exposed, but said the 30 men who remain are living with their past experiences. The UN inspector reserved some of her harshest criticism for the fact that 19 of the 30 detainees have never been charged with any crime, some of whom have been held in the military camp for 2 decades. She said their situation was a matter of profound concern. The problem was compounded by the post-9/11 CIA torture program, which has become a roadblock for some of the detainees going to trial. The UN inspector said that continued internment of some men flowed from the unwillingness of the authorities to face the consequences of the torture and other ill-treatment to which the detainees were subjected and not from any ongoing threat they are believed to pose. The UN inspector said that the use of torture had also been a betrayal of the rights of victims and called for an apology and guarantees that the abuses would not happen again. She also said, "The detainees' past experiences of torture live with them in the present without any obvious end in sight, including because they have not received any adequate torture rehabilitation to date." She said the 30 men still face harsh treatment, including constant surveillance, forced removal from their cells, and the unjust use of restraints. Monday marked the UN observance of the International Day in Support of Victims of Torture. The U.S. State Department issued a statement that said the U.S. reaffirms its condemnation of torture wherever and whenever it occurs and stands in solidarity with victims and survivors of torture around the world. The statement comes as the Biden administration is seeking the extradition of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange for his role in exposing U.S. war crimes. Assange has been held in London's Belmarsh prison on no charges since April 2019. Nils Melzer, a Swiss professor who served as a U.N. Special Rapporteur on Torture from 2016 to 2022, determined that Assange's treatment amounts to prolonged psychological torture. The U.S. government gave its response to the UN report in a one-page letter from the Ambassador to the Human Rights Council, Michelle Taylor. It said that the U.S. believed that all UN member states should be willing to open themselves to the scrutiny of outside observers. But Taylor added that the U.S. was confident that the conditions of confinement at Guantanamo Bay are humane and reflect the United States' respect for and protection of human rights for all who are within our custody. In May, The Guardian published a series of detailed drawings and writings by Abu Zubaydah, which give the most comprehensive account yet seen of the torture to which he and other detainees were subjected by the CIA. Zubaydah is known as a forever prisoner. He's being held at Guantanamo, having never been charged and with no prospect of release. Many of the individuals who were tortured under the CIA program have endured severe ongoing psychological and physical damage and trauma as a result. The Guantanamo Bay prison was set up in 2002 by then U.S. President George W. Bush and held about 800 inmates at its peak before the numbers started to shrink. President Joe Biden had promised to close the facility, but has yet to present a plan to do so. Human rights advocates are increasingly frustrated with Biden for failing to deliver on his pledge to close the prison, leaving inmates languishing in the notorious offshore detention center with no end in sight. The case of America's hypocritical actions in the field of human rights is something that has attracted the attention not only of international critics, but also of American experts. America's blatant crimes against humanity, including the wars in Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan, and the brutal torture in Abu Ghraib, Bagram, and Guantanamo Bay prisons, are not hidden from anyone. And of course, the United States has the most inhumane human rights record with its full support of Israel.
France has been rocked by violent protests over the killing of a 17-year-old teenage boy by police. The deadly incident happened during a traffic check in the Paris suburb on Tuesday. The victim, identified as Nahal M. from Nanterre, was pulled over by two police officers for allegedly breaking traffic rules while driving a yellow Mercedes. Police initially reported that an officer had shot at the teenager because he was driving his car at him, but this version of events was contradicted by a video circulating on social media. That footage shows the two police officers standing by the side of the stationary car, with one pointing a weapon at the driver. The lawyer of the victim's family has said an additional complaint would be filed for false testimony over the allegation that Nahel had tried to run over the police officer. Protests broke out in the suburb of Paris, but have since spread to other major cities, including Toulouse, Lille, Lyon, and Nice.
En fait, c'est un petit garçon. Il est super gentil.
Nahal was a young man. He is very kind. He is not evil or a hooligan. What the media are saying on him is not true. His mom raised him well. His grandmother we know here around the neighborhood. She is kind and helpful. She loves everyone. The young man left us for nothing.
Voilà. C'est vrai. On ne dit pas contraire pour l'État.
Protesters bombarded police with fireworks, set garbage containers on fire, and torched several cars. Reports also say Molotov cocktails and stones were thrown at police vans. 2,000 officers and gendarmes were put on alert in the greater Paris area. The officer who fired the fatal shot has been placed under arrest and charged with intentional homicide. Police also received an emergency authorization to use surveillance drones in Nanterre. They have arrested dozens of people there and other hotspot areas. President Macron has described the incident as, quote, inexplicable and inexcusable. He also pledged justice for the victim and called for calm.
I would like to express the emotion of the entire nation at what has happened and the death of young Nahel. We have a teenager who has been killed. It's inexplicable and inexcusable.
The incident has reignited debate in France about police tactics amid long-standing criticism from rights groups about the treatment of people in low-income suburbs, particularly ethnic minorities. Last year, 13 people were killed in France after refusing to stop for police traffic checks. The killings follow a law change in 2017 that gave greater powers to officers to use their weapons, leaving too much room for arbitrary and biased decisions. In 2016, Adama Traoré, 24-year-old black man, died in police custody in Beaumont-sur-Oise, sparking weeks of violent protests. France is haunted by the prospect of a repeat of the 2005 riots, sparked by the death of two black boys during a police chase. Those protests resulted in about 10,000 cars being burned and 6,000 people arrested. The police has been accused of targeting minorities, including children as young as 10, older children, and adults. Members of minority groups are often stopped and subjected to invasive, humiliating body pat-downs and searches of personal belongings. Furthermore, police has been accused of ethnic profiling. The practice means stopping people based on appearance, including race and ethnicity, rather than the person's behavior or a reasonable suspicion of wrongdoing.
The idea that France has had issues assimilating its quote-unquote immigrant population is an interesting one. In the United States, just like in France, when you talk about immigrants, one knows automatically what immigrants we're talking about. If I was to say France's immigrant problem, nobody will assume that I'm talking about Italian or Portuguese folks who have immigrated to France in the last 50, 60, 70 years. Automatically, the notion of immigrant is stigmatized and also racialized. We know what kind of bodies we expect to see. We expect to see Muslim immigrants largely from North Africa.
Police often target minority youth, including young children, for the stops. Abusive and discriminatory identity checks are a long-standing problem in France and are at the heart of concerns around institutional racism and discrimination. Islamophobia is also the cause of widespread concern in France. The phenomenon is closely linked to racism. Since 2015, the French government has adopted various laws that Muslims say restrict their religious freedoms, including a law that was passed in 2016 that prohibits the wearing of hijabs at work. Government has also shut down mosques, Muslim-led groups, charities, and nonprofits without due process.
So I think if we see French colonialism as something that's important to how the French state operates right now, and surely many things have changed in the French state's logic in how it manages and governs Muslim communities, but nevertheless, there was this notion that Frenchness and Islam were somehow in contradiction. And indeed, I think that that is one of the kind of longer trajectory influences on current French policy.
According to a 2021 government report, job applicants with Muslim Arab-sounding names have a 32% less chance of being called in for an interview. France is home to Europe's largest Muslim population. According to government figures, Muslims represent 10% of the French population in 2019 through 2020.
Marking the anniversary of a devastating migration tragedy, human rights activists in North Africa have denounced Europe's policy toward asylum seekers who risk their lives on land or at sea to reach the continent. The Maghreb Social Forum on Migration, FSMM, issued the condemnation in an annual gathering held in the northeastern Moroccan town of Nador at the weekend. The event brought together rights activists from Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, and Libya, as well as international non-governmental organizations and African migrants associations from Spain, France, and Belgium. The participants commemorated the deaths of at least 23 African migrants who perished around this time last year trying to cross into Spain's North African autonomous city of Melilla. The incident occurred as around 2,000 people, many of them Sudanese, stormed the frontier in a bid to reach the Spanish territory. Some sources put the death toll at 37, with 76 still missing. The Moroccan government says some migrants died after falling from the fences, while others suffocated as people panicked and a stampede started. The forum called for a transnational solidarity pact with migrants, while refusing European pressure for the externalization of European borders and massive expulsions of migrants and asylum seekers. The FSMM also rejected a revision of the European Union's rules by the bloc's interior ministers to supposedly pressure member countries to share the burden of migrants and asylum seekers more equitably. It appeared for independent commissions of inquiry to be set up to look into migration tragedies in the region. The forum's annual meeting came hot on the heels of the latest migration tragedy, which sent shockwaves through the international community. Earlier this month, an overcrowded fishing trawler carrying as many as 750 migrants, including around 100 children, sank in the Mediterranean Sea. The boat was traveling from Libya to Italy when it capsized off the coast of Greece. Dozens still remain unaccounted for. According to the International Organization for Migration, over 2,400 migrants died or disappeared in the Mediterranean in 2022. And so far this year, nearly 1,200 such cases have occurred. Across the world, there are currently more than 89 million displaced people. Of them, 36.1 million are refugees who have fled to another country. This is a historically high figure, which shows that a large number of people are in need of protection. European countries are among the most popular destinations that asylum seekers seek refuge to. However, many European countries also have little to be proud of. In total, EU countries have provided protection to 3 million refugees over the last 10 years, which corresponds to 0.58% of the population. The Dublin Regulation is an agreement between European countries that determines who is responsible for processing asylum applications. In essence, it states that the first European country where refugees arrive must process their asylum applications and provide protection to those who are entitled to it. For a long time, this was not complied with in practice, and most of those who arrived in Greece, Italy, and Spain would travel on to countries further north in Europe to seek asylum. The refugees themselves often wanted to seek asylum further north, and the Mediterranean countries were happy to avoid the responsibility. In recent years, this has changed. The large influx of refugees to Europe in 2015 led to the EU to demand that the Dublin Regulation be practiced consistently. This made it clear that the Dublin Regulation has a major shortcoming. It lacks a distribution mechanism that obliges other EU countries to relieve those nations which take responsibility on behalf of the rest of the bloc. In 2015, the EU adopted a temporary relocation scheme that required other EU countries to receive asylum seekers from Italy and Greece for a period of 2 years. The decision was met with great opposition, especially in countries such as Poland, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, and Hungary, with all refusing to accept the number imposed on them. The strong opposition meant that there was no permanent arrangement for sharing responsibilities when the temporary agreement expired in 2017. In recent years, therefore, Italy and Greece have largely been left to themselves. They have received financial support from the EU to strengthen their asylum systems, but while some EU countries have voluntarily chosen to accept some refugees, most have refused to do so.
Israeli settlers' violence against Palestinians has been on the rise. In the latest development, the settlers in the occupied West Bank village of Umm Safa, near Ramallah, attacked Palestinians and torched two of their homes on Saturday. Residents of the village said the attack happened after Palestinians prevented settlers to build an outpost in the area.
What happened today has been going on since Thursday. Settlers tried to set up a settlement on village land, and Palestinian families have been stopping them for 2 days. The families, together with villagers from nearby, tore down this outpost yesterday. It looks like the settlers didn't like it, so they attacked us this morning from many sides of the village.
The attack followed an anti-Israeli operation in which at least two Israelis, including a soldier, were injured at Qalandia checkpoint north of the West Bank city of Al-Quds. Israeli troops killed a Palestinian who opened fire on regime forces. The 18-year-old was shot by live bullets. The Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, the military wing of the Palestinian Fatah movement, took responsibility for the attack. In another incident, Israeli settlers rampaged through Palestinian towns in the occupied West Bank on Wednesday, setting buildings and cars on fire. Health officials said one Palestinian was shot dead during the settlers' attack, while at least one other was critically injured. The attack followed a similar assault on Monday. Backed by the Israeli army and military choppers, Israeli settlers raided Jenin refugee camp, killing at least 10 people, including a 15-year-old girl. Israeli forces shot her in the head while she was filming the regime's armored vehicles. Dozens of Palestinians were injured, some of them critically, during the incursion. Palestinian resistance fighters conducted a retaliatory operation in an area between the cities of Nablus and Ramallah, killing 4 Israeli settlers there. The fighters were killed in exchange of fire with Israeli settlers and troops. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas claimed responsibility for that attack. The Monday raid came as residents of a number of other Palestinian towns have reported settler violence in the area. The recent attacks by Israeli settlers against Palestinians have been to the extent which has drawn reactions from not only the Palestinian officials, but also international rights bodies. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry has blamed the Israeli Prime Minister and his cabinet for the violence. The ministry says the attacks, which are incited by some far-right Israeli ministers, is a policy adopted by the regime's cabinet to murder Palestinians. It also condemned rising crimes committed by the Israeli forces. The United Nations called for an immediate end to violence in the occupied West Bank.
This week's violence in the occupied West Bank risks spiraling out of control, fueled by strident political rhetoric and an escalation in the use of advanced military weaponry by Israel. This sharp deterioration is having a terrible impact on both Palestinians and Israelis, and we call for an immediate end to the violence.
Lawrence was particularly referring to the Israeli Monday raid on Jenin refugee camp. He called the Jenin attack a major intensification of the use of weaponry, more generally associated with the conduct of armed hostilities rather than a law enforcement operation. The UN official said international human rights law requires Israeli authorities to ensure that all operations are planned and implemented to minimize the use of lethal force. He said Israel must urgently reset its policies and actions in the West Bank in line with international human rights standards, including protecting and respecting the right to life. The recent Israeli settler violence against Palestinians is, as their foreign ministry says, rooted in extremism and far-right mentality of Netanyahu cabinet. Testimony to that is a recent call by Israeli far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gavir for the assassination of thousands of Palestinians. The hawkish minister has also thrown his full backing behind Israeli settlers and called for the construction of more settlements in the West Bank. The recent Israeli settler violence against Palestinians and the growing power of far-right groups and religious hardliners in the Israeli cabinet are very alarming. If the regime does not put an end to such practices, what could not be beyond doubt is another intifada waiting to happen. Not only that, such provocative moves will eventually make the entire region erupt in flames.
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The EU has no capacity to finance important new initiatives without cutting on essential projects. The news was recently reflected in European newspapers. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Handelsblatt newspaper wrote recently, higher interest rates have added pressure to the EU's long-term budget already squeezed by multiple crises, including the conflict in Eastern Europe, migration and energy supply shortages. In the aftermath of the pandemic, those issues are overwhelming the EU's financial resources, the German outlet wrote. Budget reserves are practically exhausted, the article says, while challenges are growing and Brussels' ability to act is dwindling. The report comes ahead of an EU review of its 2024 budget as well as the so-called multi-annual financial framework, MFF, for the years 2021 to 2027. According to Handelsblatt newspaper, the EU member states' willingness to cover the costs of the single budget is low, particularly in Germany, the most important net contributor to the Union. All of this could undermine the EU's capacity to finance its priorities or react to unforeseen events and puts flagship programs at risk, the outlet warns. Handelsblatt concluded, the bloc has a lot of mandatory spending, which leaves it with less than 30 billion euros, that is $30 billion a year, to support Ukraine, accelerate the energy transformation, strengthen the chip industry, boost domestic clean tech production, open up new sources of raw materials, and counter China's Silk Road Initiative. The outlet also said, confined to rigid mandatory spending, the EU cannot rise to become a geopolitical power, noting that with the current budgetary structure, the economic bloc is not up to its challenges. Meanwhile, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán has said the European Union is losing its competitiveness and needs more people with commitment and passion. There is an increasing amount of blah blah in EU politics, the Eurosceptic Premier claimed recently after meeting in Budapest with Santiago Abascal, the leader of a Spanish far-right Vox party. Orbán said politicians in Brussels repeat things the meaning of which we do not even know again and again, but there is no action at the end. According to the Hungarian Prime Minister, the EU needs politicians who want something, who still have energy, dedication and passion. In his view, those who think along such lines should work together. Commenting on his meeting with Abascal, he said two politicians agreed to continue cooperation between Spain's Vox party and the Orbán-led right-wing Fidesz party. Orban was quoted as saying, "We would like to see a right-wing turn in Europe as well." One of the most vocal critics of EU policies, the Hungarian leader has lately been at odds with Brussels over a number of issues, including sanctions against Russia, over the conflict with Ukraine. Orban has described the measures as miscalculated and warned they could destroy Europe's economy instead of forcing Moscow to change course. Meanwhile, RT noted factory orders in Germany dropped in April amid persistently high prices that caused a decline in large-scale purchases. Data from the country's Federal Statistics Office, DStatis, has shown recently. Overall, new orders in manufacturing fell by 0.4% from the previous month. The drop in bookings was smaller than in March, when they plummeted 10.9% from February, the biggest fall since April 2020 during the COVID-19 lockdowns. However, the decline was notable in comparison to last year's figures, with orders plunging 9.9% versus last April. The data revealed significant differences in order across industrial sectors. Bookings in machinery and equipment manufacturing fell 6.2% month-on-month in April, while miscellaneous vehicle construction, which includes ships, trains, aircraft, spacecraft, and army vehicles, showed a 34% plunge. These sectors had a particularly strong negative impact on the overall statistics, the study said. Now, new orders in the consumer goods and capital goods sectors also have dropped by 2.5% and 1.7% respectively. Electrical equipment and motor vehicles, on the other hand, saw respective gains of 12% and 2.4%. Overall, domestic orders were slightly up by 1.6%. Foreign orders, meanwhile, dropped by 1.8%. Analysts attribute the drop in manufacturing orders to elevated prices and tight monetary policy, which are dragging down demand. Germany has formally entered a recession after seeing two consecutive quarters of economic contraction. The German Economy Ministry has said that the country's export-oriented economy is suffering particularly from the still weak global economy and the decline in orders from the euro area. According to economists at Commerzbank, the existing order backlog may be sufficient to support German industry for a few months. However, given the dearth of new orders, industrial activity is likely to see a significant decline in the second half of the year. Industry is then likely to play a major role in causing the German economy to contract again.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ayatollah Khamenei elaborates on six key points of Imam Khomeini's testament, June 4, 2018. From the beginning of the revolution to the last day of his life, and in his testament, our magnanimous Imam used to emphasize the fact that the revolutionary spirit is the spirit of progress and innovation. That was what the Iranian nation experienced. The Iranian nation believes in its capabilities today. The people are confident enough to enter scientific and political arenas. Whenever the Iranian nation has seriously entered an arena, it has managed to take the lead. Our status in scientific innovations, political power, and international grandeur is not comparable to the pre-revolution era. The nation of this era has awoken. It has been revitalized, all due to the revolution. The more this revolutionary spirit is revitalized, and the more dynamic it is, the more revitalized the spirit of innovation and creativity will be, just as the revolution itself, which was a great innovation.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Through the Islamic Revolution and by the establishment of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini provided a middle ground between West toxication and backwardness. Before that, nations believed that they had to either remain ignorant or become westernized. But the Imam proved that there was a straight path which led to progress without being West toxified or falling victim to the West. Dear youth, in order to help your country progress, you must tread this straight path as tenaciously as possible. You can remove all obstacles in your way by relying on Allah, the Exalted, and your internal power. The other point that stands out in Imam's testament is the need for attention toward Cold War and psychological warfare waged by the enemy. Whenever the enemy fails to achieve its goal in practice, it resorts to psychological warfare to dishearten nations and fill their hearts with despair. Through psychological warfare and intimidation, they try to convince other nations to end their opposition. This can only mean that they have not been able to resist our nation in practical arenas. The enemy's psychological warfare started in the early days after the revolution, and it has continued to this day.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
With you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the Limelight.
$15 million Americans are expected to lose Medicaid coverage, and nearly 7 million others may lose it solely due to logistical problems. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truth Out wrote in this regard, healthcare in the U.S. is such that even this rather modest policy shift caused the rate of uninsured U.S. residents to fall to the lowest level in its history, per a press release from Democrats on the Energy and Commerce Committee that claimed. Between increased retention and new enrollments, the Medicaid rolls expanded by 23 million. These statistics indicate not the extraordinary generosity of the government during the crisis, but rather the desperate condition of so many U.S. citizens. Such minimal assistance can drastically change their circumstances. But the official end of the public health emergency has now been declared, accurately or not. As such, states are now poised to return not only to previous conditions, but to go further, reducing Medicaid enrollments to below its pre-COVID numbers. A great reset, you might call it. The brief experiment in decency now concluded. It is time to strip the unworthy of their ill-gotten care. The 2022 Consolidated Appropriations Act prepared the ground for the end of FFCRA, funding the mechanisms necessary for states to resume redeterminations, in other words, deciding who to boot off the benefit rolls. Over the next 12 months, the states are required to review all 93 million Medicaid enrollees for eligibility, a huge undertaking that is unheard of in Medicaid's history. Only a few months into this process, millions have already lost coverage, per the Kaiser Family Foundation KFF tracker. Information released by the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluations Office of Health Policy Projects that, in total, 15 million people, or 17.4% of all enrollees nationwide, are likely to lose Medicaid, whether because they have become officially ineligible since the FFCRA or for reasons of administrative churn. Churn here refers to procedural disenrollment. Again, a loss of coverage not because of a recipient has become ineligible, but due to logistical problems. This churn is projected to account for over 6.8 million removals. Ali Gardner is a senior research associate at the Georgetown University McCurtis School of Public Policy Center for Children and Families. As she described to Truth Out, our biggest concern going into the FFCRA unwinding has come true. People are being disenrolled, not because they are being found ineligible for coverage, but because they are being caught in red tape barriers. The proverbial red tape has already tied down coverage for Amy Lindsay, an Arkansas resident who is contending with precarious circumstances as she raises her 5-month-old. she said. It's been difficult and stressful, adding, I'm living on a pretty low income right now. I'm a single mom and I'm working two jobs, and I don't have the benefits that I used to, like food stamps. And now her Medicaid coverage has been lost. Lindsay had been on Medicaid for over a year before the pandemic. But when Arkansas' redetermination process began, she found she'd been unceremoniously disenrolled. Advocating for her case was a month-long challenge and a logistical nightmare. She said, they were telling me that they were never able to make contact with me. They said that they sent me email, sent me documents, sent me letters telling me that my coverage would get taken away if I didn't bring in proper things. In fact, the instructions can be outright misleading. According to Gartner, a number of states told enrollees words to the effect that if you get a notice from the state, you don't need to worry about it. Toss it. Don't pay attention to it. There has not been a clear messaging shift, she added, around the fact that notices are now important and are required to maintain Medicaid eligibility. Such maddening states of affairs are not uncommon in the United States. In fact, they currently seem to be more common than not. Statistics assembled by the KFF, which is tracking the ongoing Medicaid review across all the states of the United States with available data, indicate that as of late June, procedural terminations constitute a full 73% of the total. In some states, per the KFF, procedural disenrollment rates are presently exceeding 95%. Over time, this will decrease. These statistics are front-loaded due to the ordering of the purges, and ASPE estimates that the final procedural disenrollment rates will reach 30%. There is also a caveat to note. It's likely that some of those removed for procedural reasons may also have become ineligible and would have been dropped anyway. Still, as the KFF also reported, nearly two-thirds of current Medicaid enrollees in the United States said they did not have a change in income or circumstance in the past year that would make them ineligible for Medicaid. On the whole, the survey findings suggest many of the people whose coverage was terminated for procedural reasons in the past months likely remained eligible. Even if the rate settles to the predicted 30%, it feels still be a startling figure. We might wonder how so many errors could possibly occur in the basic mechanisms of such a venerated program, especially one that dates back 60 years.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The city of Melitopol in the Zaporizhia region, it was taken by Russia in February last year. With no soldiers patrolling the streets, it doesn't feel like an occupied city, but there is an active insurgency targeting officials. While the Ukrainian counteroffensive falters 70 kilometers to the north, I meet with the Russian-appointed governor of the region in his underground bunker.
Driving through the Zaporozhye region, it's clear the Russians were well prepared. Defensive lines, anti-tank dragon teeth, right throughout the region, even far to the south.
The governor now has his sights set on the city of Zaporozhye, which is still under Ukrainian control. The streets are lined with Russian flags and billboards. This one says, "Russia is the country of opportunities. More opportunities for you." There are, without doubt, a lot more pro-Ukrainians here than in Donetsk. With the large pro-Russian population and those who just want peace, whether they live in Russia or Ukraine, the battle for hearts and minds in Zaporozhye will at least be far easier than for the Americans in Iraq. Meanwhile, thousands of Ukrainian soldiers are being sent to their deaths and billions of dollars spent in efforts to take back towns like this. Increasingly, questions are being asked, is it worth it? Jenny Miller, Zaporozhye.
Denouncing the act of blasphemy in the strongest terms. A group of protesters, including university students, gathered outside the Swedish embassy to protest the desecration of the Holy Quran by chanting slogans and carrying placards condemning the blasphemous move.
I've come here to say that the Holy Quran is very dear to us, and Sweden should not allow this amount of disrespect to our beliefs. This book should be respected because the names of other religious books like the Bible and the Torah are mentioned in it. Anyone who disrespects this book is also disrespecting Christians and Jews.
This level of blasphemy is totally unacceptable. We have come here to defend our beliefs, the Holy Quran and Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. My husband and my son have also joined me to send this message to the world. In Sweden, they have disrespected our holy book. No act of sacrilege can ever be considered acceptable.
The angry protesters also set the Swedish flag on fire. Meanwhile, the Iranian Foreign Ministry has summoned Sweden's charge d'affaires in Tehran and has also called for an emergency meeting of the foreign ministers of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation.
The huge crowds that have gathered in front of the Swedish embassy in Tehran are also demanding the embassy to be closed down. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
After a long legal battle against the UK government's so-called Rwanda deportation plan, a welcome victory for rights campaigners and asylum seekers.
The result is that the High Court's decision that Rwanda was a safe third country is reversed, and that unless and until the deficiencies in its asylum processes are corrected, removal of asylum seekers to Rwanda will be unlawful.
It was a majority vote in the Royal Court of Appeal against a High Court decision in December last year that would have allowed the government to send asylum seekers arriving in the UK on small boats across the English Channel from France on a one-way trip to Rwanda, a plan slated by campaigners as immoral.
It's inhumane. They're treating people like they're not human beings. The reason why people are arriving on small boats in the UK is because they don't have safe passage. It's a deeply racist policy because it particularly impacts on communities that are already racialized, already face the most race discrimination in the world. And this challenge by the government needs to stop.
That is yet to happen. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, who is grappling with high inflation, rising interest rates, and declining public support, has made this scheme one of his priorities. Reacting to the ruling, he said he disagreed with the court's decision and would do whatever necessary to make the deportations happen. According to official figures, more than 45,000 people entered the UK by crossing the channel in 2022, a jump of more than 17,000.